DJ Dubhead Mobile.
2VNG, how's it going?
Yo, clear and clear. I figured the fog would have lifted by now. I was going to go up with the multirotor and take some pictures at 400 feet, but I'm afraid all I'd see is white.
All you're supposed to see is white. Okay, bad joke. Now, I don't have fog here. It must be a local thing. I'm
going to take some twilight or dark going to daylight. I guess that's twilight. Maybe that's something. Maybe that's for nighttime instead of daytime. Pictures this morning, but it had started raining early. Now it's not raining, but as foggy as it can be.
Here, I would say overcast, but I wouldn't really say foggy. There was probably fog earlier. It looks like there was rain earlier. You know, I don't know. I kind of just got up.
And knocking out the grocery store trip first, and then I'll come back and load up and make several passes to the transfer station, going underneath the high-tension power lines, the one on those towers, and you can barely see the top of the tower. It's so foggy up there.
Brooks probably aren't that high. Yeah, if there was fog, I'm not seeing it, although I do have pretty much total overcast. Where's that comet that's supposed to be in the sky? The one that no one's seen in 50,000 years.
What was the question? State that question again.
It's supposed to be in the sky. There's some comet that only comes once every 50,000 years. But we've had nothing but overcast here anyway.
I'm talking about that on the net. He'd be the one to ask. Or Google. Either John or Google would be the one to ask on where it is. They're still talking about that foreign visitor. Remember what they called that thing? It had a Japanese name. Long, narrow rock. Remember that?
Something. It was actually a Polynesian name. So the Keck Observatory in Hawaii was the one that found it. That was probably some sort of frozen remnant from outside the solar system. And you'll probably never see that one again.
Yes, they said that's the first time we had a visitor like that from you know, outside of our solar system. I don't know if it was from the inside of the Milky Way or from outside of the Milky Way.
Really determine that. Maybe from the trajectory it's on, or maybe the escape velocity, you know, what the velocity would have been coming into the system. You know it's from outside the system, or it's just a very, 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 very long period of comets. I'm not sure how you determine that.
Would do it that way, you know, just take, you know, look at the 3 or 4 points on its trajectory and then calculate backwards to see where it came from. But the problem with that is when it goes past a star, it heats up. And when it heats up, it outgasses. And those outgasses are like jet streams, and they change its trajectory. So you can't really rely on, you know, 3 or 4 points along the path that you as an observer see. That's the path that it's had since the last time its path was changed.
It can predict with pretty good accuracy the orbit of something that has an orbital period of hundreds or thousands of years. For example, since its discovery, Pluto hasn't even made it once around the sun. But we still have a pretty good idea where its orbit is.
Amazing. That's mathematics. Math is amazing. It doesn't care how big it is or how long it's been running. You get the same. You get the answer either way. You know, anyway, I'm going to go in here and make a pass through Ingalls, lighten my wallet a little bit, but fill the cupboards up. Maybe I'll talk to you when I get out. KD2BNG, W4DJW.
4DJW, KD2BNG. Yeah, I just came out here to get cat food, so let me do that. I'll talk to you later, 73.
KR8MR.
R8MR, KD2BNG, morning.
How you doing? Driving in the rain, sounds like.
Car, but I'm basically sitting in the driveway. I just came to get the cats more cat food, and I found one of them in the car. Apparently been here overnight. That's why during the summertime, when it gets warmer, I always try to crack the windows. You don't want to create a situation where, let's just say it's not a pretty one.
In the car, I made the mistake. I got a medium-sized dog. He's about just over 50 pounds, and I took him to the gate, and I left the windows down 6, 7, 8 inches, and he wanted to get out so bad, he ended up busting a window out into the parking lot, and I had him look at the cameras later to make sure that's what happened. Somebody else didn't break it, but you could see it was broken from the inside out. I guess he scared himself, and so he never got out of the car. He was still in the car when I came out there, but that's the last time I'll have to do that. I don't know. I just won't ride him around when it's hot.
Dogs, this is going to sound strange, but a dog actually ate my car. that requires an explanation. I come out here one day, and I'd been gone for a while. I come out here one day, and I need to drive the car somewhere, and it won't move because the plastic front bumper panels, some dog had chewed on them and ripped them out to the point where they were touching the tires. And there's little teeth marks around the outdoor of the wheel well. At first I thought for some reason somebody had sabotaged the car, although they did it in a weird way. I actually called the local sheriff, and he looked at it right away. Oh no, a dog did that. Seriously? Shoot holes in the bumper? But yeah, that's the dog ate my car story.
I call it urethane reaction injection molded bumpers.
Actually, I got to replace that entire front bumper assembly. And the teeth marks are actually on the left, let's see, on the right side. The right front wheel, the teeth marks are actually along the top of the wheel well. I think it was after a cat is what was happening. I got quite a lot of cats around here. But I wish I had had a doorbell camera or a deer camera or something set up to see what had happened, but I didn't. So I guess I'll never know.
Or something that's activated by motion so it's not just recording forever?
Generally the way you set it up. The ones I had, you can set up to record it if it sees, the passive infrared sensor, if it sees motion. You could also record on an interval timer. Take a picture every minute, 30 seconds, or whatever, and just set it up that way. And of course, that ends up being a lot of pictures.
Expensive dash camera that I got at Walmart, and it's got a little SD card in it, and I think you can pull that card out if you got a Android and stick it in your phone and see what was recorded. A friend of mine's got one. I actually had two for a while, but he says he's not real happy with the visual quality of it. I guess it's not very, the resolution's probably pretty low. I don't know. So I doubt if you'd be able to read a license plate number or something later on if you had to. But I keep that thing in the car and keep it running all the time. And I think someday if I get in an accident, maybe the cop will be able to figure it out.
This rental property in Clinton, which was abandoned for a while, it's been destroyed by now. I mean, plumbing ripped out, electrical ripped out, everything, I had those deer cameras in various places to try to figure out what was going on. And I mean, you have a problem if somebody steals the deer camera. That's a sure sign that something bad is going on. But I had them recording in interval mode because I didn't want to miss anything. And I would take the individual frames and make a little movie so I could watch like a day's worth of activity in a couple minutes. And yeah, I actually did capture, I got a bunch of photos of people and vehicles there doing who knows what. But the resolution was never good enough that I could ever identify them or the vehicles or anything else. So, it's a limited value.
I scored 360 radar detector, and there's a camera that you can associate with that radar detector. And for the money that Sensei Microwave, or I think it's Cobra now owns them, for the money that they want for this thing, it better be pretty good resolution. It looks like it's got a decent lens on it, you know. But I forget what the benefit is of having that thing associated with your radar detector.
When the radar detector detects something and the camera goes off, what does that really accomplish? Yeah, I'm not sure what that does.
The radar detector does have a Bluetooth connection to my phone, and if I run this Escort app, it will do things like that, put things up in the cloud. But the only time it does that, there's three bands that they use at least besides laser. There's X band, 10.525. There's K band around 24 gigahertz. And then there's what they call KA wide. And it's like 34, 35, 36 are the numbers that I see on the display when I see one of them. And that's the only one that it'll record and put into cloud, because it knows if you see something that's in KA band region, then you know for sure it's a cop and not a door opener, because they're the only ones that are allowed to be in that region, in that frequency band. So it'll only put KA band stuff on there, which is about right anyway. If you're on the highway, that's what they're using anymore is KA. Cincinnati, I've noticed the state troopers up there are still using some K-band now and then, and Asheville is still using X-band in places, believe it or not. But anyway, it's just fun to see where they're at, and, you know what I mean, and know that you're putting information up in the cloud when you drive by them.
That's why it's there. So when it detects KA-band radar, it automatically posts some message to the cloud, you know. And here, at these coordinates, we have KA-band radar, you know, for whatever that's worth. You know, unless they're using LIDAR, which I guess it doesn't detect. Or if they're, you know, a lot of times they're patrolling from the air. They're using what they call VASCAR, which is simply time the distance it takes the car to go between these two points. A lot of the rural, you know, the empty roads out west where you've got not a lot of traffic, they do that.
Yeah, it was notorious for that. I-71 and I-75 both have marks on the road, big white spots on the side of the road that they use to time with. And they've got a Cessna that they fly around in. I'm aware of that. I think there's another thing called VASCAR or something where they just try to pace you, or they mark a spot that you passed, and then and what time it took you to go from this point to that point, and then I guess they come through that area and they measure the distance between those two points, and they belatedly get your speed. But, yeah, that's what it does. It posts it, you know, it's got a GPS on board, and so it knows where you're at, and it posts that stuff up to the cloud. And then when you come into an area where somebody else has been and they start seeing KA band radar, then the app will connect with your radar detector, and it'll tell you that it's, that you're in an area where there's been some KA activity.
You might be right about that. VASCAR is vehicle mounted. It's sort of like set your pace to match this vehicle and then just set a timer. Right? But, you know, the aerial surveillance, yeah, I've seen the marks on the pavement in a bunch of places. Usually roads, you know, usually not that well traveled, because otherwise you'd be having too many cars you have to look out after. Right? But then it puts go into an area, your map lights up with all the speed traps. I guess that's how those navigator things determine, you know, I-95 at this exit is blocked right now, you know, go this way to get around it. It knows where the traffic is because everyone else is reporting their position.
Over the world, though, pretty much anything that anybody's ever done, Google does it, and they try to do it better. So, you know, I don't think it'll be very long before Google takes over that function completely. You know, radar and all, I don't know. You're really noisy, though. Are you pretty far away from the repeater, or are you using a handheld inside of a car, or what are you doing?
Mobile radio inside the car, and it's probably at 25 watts. Let me see if the antennas come loose again. Still a problem. Hey, you know, if I move 5 feet down the driveway, maybe it'll change. It's probably the tree to my left.
You did move a little bit there.
I grabbed the base of the antenna and tried to turn it. It wasn't even really loose. Yeah, you know, the feed line could be going 22. You know, you get, I guess you get corrosion at the base of the antenna, or corrosion at the where the feed line comes in. So I should probably replace, it's just a mag mount base. You get another mag mount base, it comes with another feed line, and that solves the problem for another year or two.
What I've been finding is that, you know, unless you're willing to take it apart and try to fix it, you know, I just go buy a new one. How far away are you? Where are you located, roughly?
On Caesar's Head, and I'm in Gray Court. I think that's over 40 miles, maybe closer to 50 miles.
Down south pretty good, then. Yeah, I used to work at ZF before I retired. That's the last place I worked.
Dude, they rebuild transmissions, or they have their own manufacturing of new transmissions? Or they're kind of like the Jasper company for transmissions. Yeah, we rebuild all these things.
Well, they don't rebuild anything. They've got machine tools there, and they make their own gears and everything, and shafts, and they've got balancing equipment in there, and they assemble transmissions for Honda and Nissan, and I couldn't name who all they've made transmissions for, but it's all new transmissions that they're making, and that factory, they've actually, if you look in the backyard, there's a big hill that they mounded up, and it's because somebody got run over by one that, you know how you could put that parking pole in there and it's supposed to stop the car from moving? I guess they had one that didn't work or something and it ran somebody over. So now they've got like a little test track back there where they can put a car, you know, mount the transmissions on a car and put the car on a hill or whatever and make sure the parking pole works or something like that. I don't know. But I know they've got some test things that they do there, too. I worked there for about, I don't know, just over maybe a year or two before COVID hit.
Kim, we make brand-new products for Honda, you know, Nissan, Toyota, everybody else. All right, so yeah, that's all new fabrication. Yeah, I didn't really know. Yeah, so it's, you know, one of those companies whose name you don't see out there generally because we don't put our name on it. We're an OEM for everybody else.
I collaborated with Ford for a while, and they made that continuously variable transmission. But that wasn't a very good collaboration, from what I understand. But yeah, the word, this ZF is actually kind of like a shortened acronym or something for a really long German word that means gear factory, I think. But that company goes all the way back to Hindenburg times, and they're actually the company that made the Hindenburg a long time ago.
The airship, well, you know, except for the one problem. But that was actually the flagship of airships. That was the airship equivalent of like a seagoing luxury liner, from what I've read of it.
Compared the size of the Titanic with modern ships, and that thing was small compared to some of these modern cruise ships that they got going now.
Titanic or Queen Mary or one of those earlier generations, yeah, they're little tiny things. You've got things now that are 1,000 feet long, and they're like 10 stories, 15 stories tall. You know, the beam on them is like, I don't know how, 200, 300 feet. You know, they're like as wide as a football field, or maybe not quite. But yeah, they're basically floating. It's a block of floating apartments. And the thing about that, too, is you wonder, if you build up that high, and how wide is the, you know, where's the center of gravity on that thing? And I wouldn't want to have a wave hit me sideways.
Waves they've been having down South America, off the tip of South America and over towards South Africa. I think there was a boat had an accident down there off South America recently with a rogue wave. And then I think there was a shoreline or somewhere maybe in South Africa recently where they had a rogue wave show up on shore.
Something to do with the ocean, you know, the ocean at that point getting narrower, and hot and cold water from different oceans coming together, and different air masses coming together, and yeah, there's a whole graveyard of ships that, you know, tried to sail around, didn't quite make it. Yeah, rogue waves and rogue storms come out of nowhere, and it's clear, and then literally 10 minutes later, there's a, almost hurricane force wind.
Some people are thinking this Devil's Triangle down by us is there's maybe some areas in there where suddenly a whole bunch of methane gas comes up out of the water, and now your buoyancy is like zero and you sink.
More sense than the lost city of Atlantis, the anti-gravity generator, or the home base for UFOs from whatever planet they're from. Oh, yeah, I might have heard that, too. There's a methane bubble under, what was it in ancient times? The Sargasso Sea. That the floor is all frozen methane. And now with global warming, you have the methane unfreezes, and it bursts out this huge bubble. Yeah, now that you mention it, I have heard that.
Going to Ohio State University, we had a diving well, and you could turn on these bubbles. They had like holes in the sides of the diving well, and you could turn on this bubble machine, and it would really stir up the water, put a whole lot of air in the water, and you couldn't smack up if you tried. You could come off the 20-foot diving board and not even smack.
State bubble explain what some say is an unusually large number of aircraft that have gone down in that region. The bubbles would disturb the surface of the water, because in addition to maybe what I guess are hundreds of ships, you have just as many aircraft that supposedly disappeared for no good reason. But, you know, aircraft disappear for no good reason. It happens.
I was wondering, yesterday when we had that, I guess I don't think it's going on anymore, but the Notice to Airmen, NOTAMs system went down, and so an airline, I don't know what airline it was, they decided, well, because of this, we're not going to fly. And then soon after, the government said nobody's going to fly until they get it fixed. And the guy at Biden wanted to know what caused it. He wants somebody to report directly to him to tell him what caused it and if it was a cyber attack. And they're saying that it was not a cyber attack, or they don't think it was. The system is so old, I can't imagine somebody even knowing how to program the thing anymore. But I really wonder if it was a cyber attack, if they would admit it.
It's a Y2K thing. It's just a few years too late. Yeah, you got to understand another concerning possibility is the software that runs the air traffic control system, at least over most of the United States and North America, is probably just as old. It's software that goes back maybe to the 1980s. It's never been updated because, well, you know, it's working. Yeah, the Notice to Airmen software. Yeah, I was just going to say, it wasn't just one airline that got grounded, it was all of them. It's not, you know, I don't imagine it's common for the FAA to say, we have to ground everything. every single plane is on the ground for the next 24 hours or whatever. You know, I've only ever seen that happen one other time, which was right after September 11th, 2001. At that time, I lived near Miami Airport. Going by on the Florida Turnpike, you would always see a line of planes waiting to land, you know, coming from the west or whatever, and it was weird to see no planes landing there.
Either. Yeah, I didn't hear anything out of GSP yesterday, and honestly, I haven't really heard anything today either.
They have their radio frequencies written down somewhere. I don't hear anything out of them generally. Maybe I'm too far away, or maybe I just don't have the right equipment. You know, I've got one handheld Navcom radio. I could maybe hook up to a better antenna. But I've listened for, yeah, maybe that's what I'll do. I'll put a proper antenna on that thing. I've listened for GSP. I haven't heard much. Now, when I lived near JFK, of course, I used to hear quite a lot.
I'm on the back course for runway 22. That's the one where they come in and they go past FedEx and land. And then there's runway, what's the opposite of 22? I can't remember now. I can't do the math. Runway 4, which is at 40 degrees. That's where they just come straight out of Atlanta and then go across Highway 14 and land. And that's typically the way they got the runway set up on days like today when the weather's crummy. And I don't know if it's got anything to do with the way the winds are. I think it's got more to do with their ILS system, or I'm not sure why it is, but it seems like whenever the weather's crummy, then they come straight up by 85 and they just go right across 14 and land on runway 4. So I don't see them when they do that, but if they come around, if they take off on runway 4 and then maybe make a left turn and come around north like that and go to Atlanta, I'll see them. But I haven't been, that's what I meant by not hearing them. Yeah, the one main frequency is kind of like 119.4, I think. KR8MR for ID.
KD2BNG. 119.4. 128, I think, is a general Unicom frequency. There aren't that many that I have written down somewhere, and I can probably look them up again. Maybe I'm just too far away and or don't have the right antenna. But I'm sure there's a couple of VOR beacons, too. I'll see if I can hook up that antenna to that radio to a better antenna. Because all it is right now is this handheld Navcom radio. And I don't know where I got it or why. I must have traded something for it. But if it's just got the rubber duck little short antenna, it's not going to pick up anything anyway until you're like right at the airport.
Hard time here. Actually, what's really weird is I live north of Taylor's, you know, like Sandy Flat, Mountain View, Blue Ridge area, and so you got Greenville, you got, you know, Greenville Municipal, you got GSP, and then down south you got Donaldson. Well, the tower that I can hear really well is Donaldson, it makes no sense to me because that's the one that's the furthest away. So they either got more watts or they're up in the air a little bit more, but I can hear that tower freak a lot better than I can like GSP tower or GMU tower.
Something. I've got some general coverage VHF, UHF radio somewhere. I'll attach it to a proper antenna. I'll build another J-pole cut to that frequency if I have to. But, yeah, when I was in the New York City area, I wasn't far from JFK Airport. And actually, that was a good radio listening environment. I used to hear all sorts of things. There was this one ship-to-shore, I guess it was ship-to-shore marine telephone. And I used to call it the Russian phone company because there was always a bunch of It sounded like personal conversations that generally always in Russian or Ukrainian or some language. But, and there was, I even heard a couple of, there was a couple of number stations that I would occasionally hear. See, that was a good listening area for whatever reason. Around here, I think for some reason, you're in the skip zone for most of these overseas stations in Europe or South America. I don't really hear them.
Talking about AirInc on HF, around, I think there's like, I'm trying to think where all the frequencies are, 11.175, I think, is Air Force, 6.7, 5.5, and then down lower, even like in the threes, I think they got a band down there, but that's called AirInc, and there's North Atlantic AirInc, and there's Pacific AirInc, and you know, they, when they get out where the VHF don't work anymore, then they talk on shortwave. I used to live in Ohio, and the whole southeast corner of Ohio is a restricted area, and they do intercepts out there, and that's fun to listen to. F-16s going at each other lately. It used to be A-7 Corsairs, but then there's a lot of guard bases nearby. There's, you know, Toledo Guard used to be there, Bear Field over in Fort Wayne, Toledo, the Stingers, F-16s or whatever they got, F-22s probably now, and then Selfridge Air National Guard Base up in Detroit. So there's all kinds of guard bases around. And then southeastern Ohio, Indiana, near Lawrenceburg, like, there was this restricted area called R-3403, and that was like a practice bombing range. And then through Kentucky, they had a VR route where they'd fly low, 400 feet, 400 knots, and they'd make a right turn over Louisville and pop up at Jefferson Proving Grounds and practice bombing, and then they'd go back home over the north side of Cincinnati. So that was a lot of fun listening. When they line up to do their fights, 70 miles on the 70-degree radial off of Cincinnati, which puts you right over the dam at East Fork Lake. So if you're at East Fork, you can watch those intercepts all day long on a Saturday. And if you look at the contrails, if you're in, you know, Westchester, where I used to live, and you watch the normal civilian air traffic going around, when that restricted area is open, you can see people flying around it. So you see these contrails that go south, and then after they get across the river, they make like a left turn and go back east again.
The other HF frequencies, they're kind of all odd number frequencies. There's a 2889 and a 3443. And, the Gander Newfoundland Tower, I think, is 5615 or 5616. Gander and Shanwick, Ireland are the two I used to pick up on HF. Now, of course, JFK being, you know, a major airport, and the, you know, New York City, that whole air corridor being a major air corridor, there were probably at least a dozen other VHF frequencies you would always, you know. The JFK Tower, I think, on 1991, and Archer on 127.4, and a bunch of others. In fact, when I used to pick up my fiance, when she would fly in from Florida, I would just sit at home and listen to the tower frequency. And when I heard her flight on the tower frequency, it's like, okay, if I leave right now, I'll be there just in time to pick her up. So that would usually be my signal to, I got to get out of the house and get over there.
We got the same listening experience, kind of. Yeah, I remember those frequencies. And they're still active today, all those HF freaks. You must be heading south, though, because you're getting a whole lot more fry going on. I'm hearing a lot more noise in the background.
Not moving. I mean, the Earth's rotating, but now I'm just sitting in the driveway, and I came out here to get cat food for the cats, and I just, one of the cats was locked in the car, so I had to release them, and so I'm just, I'm sitting here stationary.
Yes, it's about the same. I am gonna get going though soon. I got a digital radio with a hotspot, and I want to get another memory chip for it, like an SD RAM card for it, so that I can back up what's in it and then start making some changes. Everybody's on Brandmeister and on different talk groups on Brandmeister, and then there's some other like systems that you can go into their web and get on their thing, and one of them is called TGIF, and another one's like DMR Plus. There's at least four of them, and if you set your chip up right on your hotspot, you can make it so that you can go and use your radio on any of them. And there's a pretty good RagTube talk group on TGIF, and I want to get that going. And I'm thinking about going over to Rich's house Saturday. He's saying if his wife goes away for a while, he'll have some time for me. And he just got his radio working on TGIF. And so if I bring a chip down there to him, maybe he can get mine going too. So I'm looking forward to that. You can go all around the world with that as long as the web's working.
Since you got it, get into, I guess, you know, I should be more a technology person. I used to do computer design and programming, but I guess I'm just an old buddy that he is. But I'll have to explore all these different digital modes and packet networks and stuff that's out there now.
I used to write software for industrial controls, and I programmed in all seven languages, and, you know, C and Relay Ladder and, you know, you name it. And when I was with ZF, I had to stop using Allen Bradley controls and try to get familiar with Siemens industrial controls and the German language, because all the comments and symbols and things that were in these programs were in German. And you know, it's really hard when they abbreviate, you know, because you don't know what they meant. It's not something you can translate or look up when they start using abbreviations, and they do that a lot. But it just blows me away that there's people that are not trained in programming or engineering that they just go on YouTube and they're way ahead of me. I mean, they know how to program these things and how to go through all the menus and make changes to the IP addresses and you name it. And they're in business and I'm not. So I guess it's just a matter of where there's a will, there's a way. And if I was more motivated, then I'd probably be watching these YouTube videos myself. And I started watching one last night, and I just couldn't stick through the whole thing. I don't know why. Lately, my motivation's just not there. And there's some personal reasons for that, and I'm trying to fix them right now.
Yeah, C is definitely one of them. See, I was a very good C and Unix person, which is why my skill set largely hasn't changed and why it really doesn't need to. But let's see, the seven programming languages. Well, let's see, throughout history, don't forget Fortran and COBOL. There's still new developments. There's a Fortran 2018 standard, so I guess it's new. We all remember BASIC from computer science class. I remember Pascal, pretty much the same thing. Yeah, as for languages that people actually use, Python or whatever is out, JavaScript. But I still tell as an aspiring computer software people, if you're really a C expert, that's probably the more important one.
Four and what four and what five? That's what first got me interested in programming back in the late 70s. But, yeah, C is probably one of the only one that you mentioned that's part of that seven. I couldn't tell you what the seven of them are anymore. I can't really remember. Structured, I can't remember. The STL was one of them, which structured text or something like that. I can't remember. Yeah, Fortran. I remember Fortran. That was a lot of fun. Punch cards and you would stick your punch cards in a punch card reader, and then that would go over a modem. And it was one of those modems where they literally had a telephone handset stuck inside like a thing with a speaker and a microphone on it. And then that would go up to UC main campus, and they'd run the job on their computer up there, and then we had a big line printer that the answer would come back on. And my dad worked at Baldwin Piano for 30 years, and one time there was three guys that they're going to go down to Arkansas or Little Rock or wherever one of their plants was, and so they're waiting for an airplane at Grader, and the airplane was late. It was Allegheny. And so one of the guys said something like, "Oh, I know what we need to do. We'll just catch this other flight that goes to Indianapolis, and then we'll go from Indianapolis down to Arkansas. I've done it before." And the third guy said, "I'm going to go back to work." I think he was like an accountant or something. He didn't want any part of the travel changes. And he just decided he's going to go back to work. And these other two guys got on the plane. And that was the one that got run into by a Cessna on the way to Indianapolis, and of course everybody died on that thing. And the guy's name that my dad knew really well, his name was Mr. One day I'm standing there at the line printer waiting for my Fortran job to come off, and they would print your name in really big block letters, Kramer, K-R-A-M-E-R, you know, and you knew that was your job that was coming up next, and it would show to print your job. And I saw the words Hubble come up one day, and there's this red-haired kid standing next to me, and I was like, "Wow," I said, "I didn't know you were going to school here." I said, "You know, did your dad used to work at Baldwin Piano?" And he said, "Yeah." And then I was like, "Oh, wow," you know, because his dad was the one that was on that airplane.
Other languages you were trying. Now, there's an SQL, a structured query language. That's not actually a procedural language. It's like a set of filters for applying to a database. Track records from it. Yeah, let's see. CSQL. There might be five or six others that are actually. The big one now is Java. Let's see. I guess. What's the thing now for web programming? PHP and JavaScript for the client and server side of web programming. Yeah, there's probably at least seven.
Yeah, when I was leaving, actually, I got them started. I brought my Raspberry Pi in first before they had a chance to get a PO written to buy one. And so my Raspberry Pi was the first one programmed down there at ZF. And they've been sticking them around different machines to monitor when they're having problems and feed that to, like, a central location. And I think Code Red was the thing they were using for that. I wasn't involved in that. I just brought my hardware in and a proto board and let them mess around with it for a while. And all I got for my grief was I got a bad power supply back. So now I got a Raspberry Pi with no power supply. Code Red or something was this other one, along with one of the ones you just mentioned. I can't think of it now.
Code Red, you got me there. That I don't know. But, yeah, I don't know how many programming languages out there or how many were actually in use at one time or another. And, you know, there's a couple of really weird ones out there, too, that you never ever see. But, yeah, you know, I still tell people if you're a good C and Unix person, you'll always be in demand. Because Unix basically runs the internet. Most of the Unix internals and the middleware layer and all that was written to see. So, you know, we're pretty much always going to need you. And, you know, it's not especially interesting, but it is vital to the, you know, the core of what keeps an ambulance running.
I'd say I was. I mean, I wrote C. I wrote a thing a long time ago that talks ICOM CI-5 protocol to my R7000 receiver back when I was doing a lot of military listening on military UHF, like 225 to 400, and then there was like an air-to-air band around 138. And so what I did on my cathode ray tube back then, I could display all 99 channels on one screen. And then I had like a corner of the screen left over, real estate there, where I could put another five channels. And so what the thing would do was I would tell it, I had a CI-5 command to tell it to set channel, set channel, set channel, and that's how I would scan. And believe it or not, it actually set the channels faster than I could scan with it in normal mode. And then whenever it would see something, there was a recorder relay output on the thing, and I attached that to the bell line on RS-232, and then I could see when squelch break happened and stop the scan. But it was going so fast that actually I had to write code in there so that it would back up one channel whenever it saw something, because it was always on to the next channel by the time it noticed that it had squelch break. What was really cool, so I could highlight things in red on the screen, what frequencies were active during the day, and I had a unique way of scanning where I would scan 20 channels, and then if somebody was talking on any of them, well, I would scan, and then if somebody was talking on, say, channel 38, then it would put that channel in one of the priorities. And then what I would do is I'd scan 20 channels and then scan the priorities. And then I'd scan the next 20 channels and then scan the priorities. Because back then, 10 to 13 channels per second wasn't that fast. You wouldn't catch the response. And so, but you did with this thing, the way I wrote it. And I even had like a little screen grab program that would grab a picture of the screen in time. And at work, we had Banyan Vines networking system. It was a RG11 coax system. It wasn't Ethernet. And I could dial up the house at noontime and get a picture of what my screen looked like, and I could tell what was going on. Like, you could see if they were bombing Jefferson Proving Grounds, or if they were doing intercepts, or if there was, you know, you name it, or, you know, it was kind of neat. You could see how busy they were. They generally tended not to be, the military generally tended not to be busy on Mondays. They were always busy on the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, you know, and throughout the week, but for some reason they never did anything on a Monday. So if I was Russia and I was going to come after them, if they're going to come for the U.S., I'd do it on a Monday.
Repeater, time out, exit. Repeater, time out, clear.
I knew I was getting kind of long there.
The timer set on any of these radios, I've probably done the same thing. Yeah, if the timeout timer is available, something like a 2-minute timeout timer. We've all done it. I don't know what timeout value is. Probably a good 2 or 3 or 3.5 minutes. I haven't really measured it.
But it's really cool to meet you. Can you tell me your call sign again?
Kilo Delta 2 Bravo November Golf. Name's Glenn, if I didn't give it.
Bravo November Golf. Did I get that right, Glenn?
You got it.
Mine used to be KB8 DPG, and as far as I know, nobody's got that yet. And then I switched it to a vanity call back in the 90s, and it's like my last name, Kramer, so I made it KR8MR. And I used to live up in 8 Land in Cincinnati, so it was kind of legal back then, too. But everybody says you don't want to do that. You want to get a short call and all that kind of thing. And I don't know. When I'm in contests, people do seem to have a problem with it a little bit, but I don't care. I'll probably keep it till I die.
I'm obligated to change your call sign anymore if you end up moving somewhere else. You know, I wouldn't be able to remember more than one anyway. And...
if I was to get, say, what if I want to get another call sign, you know, today? Does it have to be in foreland, or can it be anything?
Transmission mostly static, so maybe we're at the useful end of our communication here. You might have gone into a dead spot.
I can't imagine why that would be. Okay, I'm on low power. Let me turn it up here. Here, there's high power. That might have been the problem. I'm on a Cushcraft AR-270 dual band vertical. It's at 20 feet, and I'm talking on an ICOM 706 stationary in my house.
Radio, I like those. I got a few radios for HF, and quite frankly, I haven't had the inclination to try to put up any kind of antenna for HF. I used to have just a long wire running between two poles, which seemed to work well enough.
Hey, I've got a vertical, a butternut vertical that does six bands, and it works really good, especially in 20-meter band. But I just recently made a dipole with a, you know, like a choke ballon thing in the middle, and I've made antennas before with that same ballon for, like, again, 20 meters, and they work fine. But this one, I made one for the work band, 18 megahertz work band, whatever, what is that, 17 meters probably or something, 18 megahertz. And I'm not getting out very good with that one. I don't know why.
Something that may be worthwhile, the MFJ has it. The kind of the octopus thing. It takes four. You have like four pairs of hamsticks. So you have a four-band antenna. Or actually, I did try the other one. It's like it takes the two hamsticks and puts them together back to back. But this one was like has eight sockets for eight, you know, four pairs of antennas. Get the, you know, the little 6 or 7 foot long hamstick antennas and use pairs of those. I may try something like that.
Do you have both a left and a right side in the same band, or do you just put one hamstick in for this band and one hamstick in for that band? I've got a couple of them right now. I couldn't tell you what bands are in. Probably 20 meters is one of them. I used to mount them on the back of my 01 Impala. Worked really good. I was getting down into South America as I was driving I-75 to Florida. They're just sitting around right now collecting dust.
He is using two-quarter wave whips to basically make two halves of a dipole. So, yeah, they do have to be in pairs. MFJ has this octagonal thing. So, you know, on each opposing set of... screws, you screw in the pair of hamsticks, and now you have a four-band, you know, whatever it is, for whatever, because, you know, logically what I'm doing is I'm taking a hamstick, I'm putting it horizontally, and I'm making it half of a dipole.
I see. Yeah, you did say it's four bands and eight sockets, so that makes sense.
You know, and the nice thing about those hamstick antennas is I think there's even, you know, most of them are like, what, 6 or 7 feet long, and they're, you know, they're base-loaded to whatever the band is. But there's shorter ones that are like, you know, a meter, 3 or 4 feet long, and if you have space restrictions, you could probably try those. But... I've had good results with the hamstick antennas in other applications. So that, you know, that might be one possibility for like a quad band antenna. I guess it would have different directionality on different bands because it's pointing four different ways.
A cul-de-sac and a subdivision, and I got 5/8 of an acre. I got a few oak trees that if I went out and bought some more coax, I could maybe make a dipole for 80-meter band, and I haven't ever gotten around to doing that yet. Hey, Glenn, I'm going to get going. I want to run to Walmart, and I want to get some lunch also on the way back. So I'm going to say 73. I don't have a radio in the car.
We'll talk to you later. What was I doing out here? Oh, yeah, cat food for the cat. Yeah, I got to go. 73, KD2BNG.
Here's Tony.